This is a Nightlife crime podcast.
We're talking crime tonight on Nightlife with true crime author and Nightlife regular crime contributor Rochelle Jackson. Tonight, a case of murder with no body and no weapon. Sue Neill Fraser is currently serving a 23-year sentence for the murder of her de facto Bob Chappell, who was last seen on January 26, 2009 in Hobart. But since being arrested for murder, she's maintained her innocence and attempted every appeal possible. And she's been supported by a number of prominent Tasmanians. However, in recent months, numerous charges have been laid for perverting the course of justice against a number of people working to clear her name. So it's a very complicated case. Rochelle, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Thanks very much, Suzanne.
Rochelle, what happened on January 26, 2009 that we know for sure?
Look, what we do know is that Sue and Bob went out on this yacht. That's what we do know. We know that there was some form of crime that occurred on Australia Day in 2009 on board their yacht, the Four Winds, while it was moored on the River Derwent off Sandy Bay. And look, this case, as you said, is very complicated. It includes a sinking boat, a missing sailor, and has been described as a society crime. In fact, it's been a case of such enormous speculation and controversy, some people have even claimed Sue Neill Fraser is our next Lindy Chamberlain. Now, I don't know if you saw the 60 Minutes story, but I remember watching this in 2014, and a legal expert then, Dr. Bob Moles, described the case as the worst miscarriage of justice in 40 years. Look, I suppose let's have a look at the evidence in this case. A little background on Sue. She's 62 years of age. She's described as a horsey person, and she used to own an equestrian school. She's the eldest of two kids of a Tasmanian-born Helen Hayes, who married a Scottish businessman. Now, the family has a long history in Tasmania. Sue's first marriage to a farrier failed, and the couple had a couple of daughters, Sarah and Emma. Bob Chappell was English-born and Melbourne-educated. Now, he was a radiologist at a Hobart cancer clinic, and he was dedicated to his work and very well paid. But his first wife left him as well, and they had a couple of kids. Sue, as you said, is currently serving 23 years in Tassie's Risdon prison for murdering Bob, and they'd been together for around about 18 years. Now, the original trial was in October 2010, and they heard evidence then, the prosecution gave, that Sue had regarded her relationship with Bob as over. In fact, Judge Alan Blow was satisfied that she'd killed him with, quote, with material gain in mind. In other words, it was assumed that she'd be able to get a bigger slice of his $1.3 million estate than she might have got if they'd been separated.
So what do they say actually happened? What do they think once this couple went out on that boat on Australia Day?
See, the interesting thing is the body and the murder weapon has never been found, but there was enough sufficient circumstantial evidence to convince the jury. Now, initially, it was reported that Bob had gone missing, and Tasmanian police saw the case as a missing persons case. And they thought, look, possibly Bob had fallen overboard or had staged his own disappearance after trying to scuttle the yacht. But as the hours passed, it seemed more likely that someone was involved. So by day three, the media was reporting this as foul play in their stories about the case. Now, what we didn't know at the time was that Tasmanian police didn't reveal every detail, Suzanne, like the fact that blood had been splattered in the cabin, which implied a blunt weapon attack. Now, the police thought initially it was very unlikely that Bob had committed suicide or faked his disappearance, and the splattered blood all but ruled out accidental drowning. Now, what they did find in the yacht was five missing carpet tiles and a fire extinguisher that was missing. The thing is, when they did this investigation or forensic testing on the yacht's dinghy, they found that there was some blood in it. So the police suspected the carpet tiles had been ditched because they were bloodstained, and that the fire extinguisher would have been an obvious choice to weigh down a body. So look, in most missing persons case, irrespective of what state it's in, Suzanne, detectives talk to the last people to see them alive. So the spouses, lovers and family members. So it made perfect sense that police interviewed Sue because she was his partner and the last person to see him alive.
And what did she say had happened?
Well, this is the really interesting case, and I can actually personally testify to looking at some of these police records of interview with Sue at that stage, because Sue Neill-Fraser, what police saw was this other side to this woman who seemed that she couldn't get her story straight. And Suzanne, I've watched some of these police records of interview, and all I can say is they're extremely frustrating to watch, because you can see why police investigators would have found it frustrating dealing with her. She just couldn't answer a simple question. The first policeman to talk to Sue the day after Bob disappeared saw that Sue's wrist was strapped and she had this band-aid on her thumb. And, you know, he didn't think that much about it until he saw a photograph of her taken at lunch the day before. There was no sign of any band-aid or bandage. So he thought she must have hurt herself the night Bob disappeared. There were some other really odd things. There was a red padded jacket that was found on the Sandy Bay waterfront near the yacht's mooring. Now, Sue's daughters, they even identified the jacket as their mother's, but Sue denied it. And it was only until forensics proved that the jacket was hers that she admitted it. So police, of course, installed listening devices and they spoke regularly to Sue while divers searched for a body in the River Derwent. Another really strange factor, Suzanne, was that in the police intercept tapes, they hear other family members speaking of Bob in the present tense, but Sue was using the past tense as if he was dead. In the first few days, she apparently searched the internet wanting to know how long before a missing person could legally be declared dead. So the police also soon found out that what she already knew was that Bob's will had been changed in her favour. She lied about knowing about that too. I mean, I think probably one of the most interesting things was about her alibi, though. When she was asked about, you know, what happened that afternoon when Bob had vanished, she claimed she'd been in a Bunnings store for hours, but, quote, had not bought anything. Now, she was very definite about this alibi, but she later withdrew it after she learnt that she couldn't have been at Bunnings for hours because the store had closed and, of course, she wasn't on any security film. So what on earth was she really doing that afternoon and that evening? Now, she'd told police she'd stayed home all night after a telephone call that ended at about 10:30 p.m. But telephone records showed that she'd dialed her callback service at 3:08 in the morning to see if anyone had called. So it meant she had been out until 3 a.m. and then lied about it. So, you know, I suppose this is in part of the original court case, Suzanne.
Mm. And this is the charges that the jury said she's guilty of murder and that the judge said, you know, I back that up.
That's right. Well, you've got to look at the original evidence and alibi, and some of the evidence the prosecution brought up was the claim that Sue had grown tired of Bob's stinginess and craved adventure. Apparently, she'd told three men she was going to leave him. Now, the most interesting thing in this case is that Tasmania, unlike any other states, had never used circumstantial evidence to convict a murderer. So it was really significant that Sue was arrested 7 months after Bob's disappearance. Now, Tasmanian police said the case was like any other missing persons inquiry for 6 weeks. That was until Sue admitted lying about her movements the night that Bob died. So she insisted that she hadn't left the house on the night, but she had also told her sister-in-law on the phone that she'd lied. And, of course, because the police had the phones off in the house, they were recording that conversation. So days later, she admitted to a reporter too, once again on the phone, that she'd gone to the waterfront that night. And one reason she'd changed her story was that the police had security film of a car identical to hers passing a local bank after midnight, which, of course, was when she claimed she was in bed. So she was arrested and this trial of 3 weeks began in October 2010.
Okay. Now, she, though, has declared her innocence the whole time, even after being found guilty. What appeals has she then lodged? Because she's taken this as far as she can.
That's right. And in fact, you know, the jury returned this unanimous guilty verdict and it took 18 hours, which is an incredibly long time to reach that verdict. But as you said, it inspired enough doubt to fuel this campaign by Sue's friends and family. And of course, as you've said, Sue Neill-Fraser's maintained her innocence from day one. So her daughters, Sarah and Emma, they're the public faces of this very large and very active campaign. They range from Sue's social circle to civil libertarians and activists who insist she's innocent. One of the mysteries of the original trial was addressed in that first appeal, which was in 2017. Now, this was about this DNA which was found of a homeless teenager, Megan Vass, which was found on the yacht. Now, at the original trial, Megan, this homeless teenager, denied ever being on board. Now, Tasmanian police said, look, the DNA sample, it might be a case of scene contamination after the event, because the boat was taken to a couple of other places and then placed in a yard in the northern suburbs. So they said it could have been transferred on a policeman's shoe. So as you can imagine, a lot was hanging on this DNA sample, as during the trial, the police, the DPP and the subsequent appeal judges all dismissed the sample found on the yacht. But, of course, the DNA of this homeless girl found on the boat has now been confirmed by Victorian Police Forensic Services Department to be of primary nature, or primary transfer in nature. In other words, it wasn't transferred by a policeman's shoe. She was there on the night.
She had unquestionably been on the yacht.
That's right. Yeah, so that contradicted the evidence that she'd given in the trial, claiming she'd never been there. So the first appeal that you mentioned, Suzanne, ended in 2012, and it shaved 3 years off Sue's original sentence but failed to overturn her conviction. So her legal team, they've lodged this appeal application in November last year. So as you mentioned, this is the last roll of the dice, the legal roll of the dice for Sue, who's still maintaining her innocence. She's got some of the best silks working with her. Tom Percy is a Perth silk, and Melbourne criminal specialist Paul Galbally. And they're attempting to use a new state law to secure a second appeal.
Now, does she have to prove that there is adequate evidence to warrant this appeal?
Yeah, she's got to, in fact, Sue's lawyers must persuade this judge, Michael Brett, that they have fresh and compelling evidence to justify the court's full bench re-examining the case. As you can imagine, this is pretty rare. She's taken this as far as she could possibly go. And really, it's her last chance appeal. And it's expected to be back in court sometime this month.
But still going around this, I mean, I know one of her supporters is a documentary maker who's been making, films. She's got a lot of high profile people on her side. Charles Woolley, the 60 Minutes reporter, the independent MP, Andrew Wilkie. But in another fascinating twist, there have been people who've been charged with perverting the course of justice in relation to evidence that they've been giving in support of her.
That's right. And see, this is the thing. I actually know you're speaking about the documentary maker and psychologist and counsellor Eve Ash. And Eve has spent a lot of time and a lot of money working on the documentary, which is hours and hours and hours and hours of footage. And she's managed to get support and get some people on board that have been working very hard to help this challenge to Sue's murder conviction. And you're right, one of them was this Stephen John Gleeson. He was someone who's been in prison, and he was has just been charged with perverting the course of justice for falsely identifying this teenager in a photograph. And, of course, the teenager is this homeless teenager, Megan Vass. And apparently Gleeson was sleeping rough in his car on that night that Bob disappeared in 2009, and he initially told police he hadn't seen anything that night. But 8 years later, and after receiving, you know, several visits by some of Eve Ash's team and lawyers in prison, he said, look, he signed affidavits saying he'd seen this homeless teenager, Megan Vass, and a male in the area. Of course, this has now been proven that it's completely false, and Gleeson's statement was the only evidence placing her at the scene on the night of the murder. So the justice gave him, I think he's been given 12 months jail sentence for giving false evidence, and the justice in his trial described his crime as extremely serious.
And yet that still doesn't explain, doesn't it, Megan Vass's DNA being on the boat that night?
It doesn't. It doesn't at all. It doesn't at all. And all we know is that, yes, we can categorically say that she was on the boat that night.
And does she have any explanations for that?
I don't know. I don't know what she's actually saying officially, but I know that they're saying that she's not the only one that was on board that yacht after supposedly Bob had gone missing. Apparently there's a number of people's DNA on that boat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's such a fascinating and complex case. And, I mean, it's going to take a lot to compel the court's full bench to re-examine this case, Suzanne, but that's what they've got to do. And Sue Neill-Fraser has every right to, you know, do exactly what she's doing.
And to what extent has this absolutely captured the attention of the Tasmanian community? Because I know that late last year, I think there were huge billboards erected all around Hobart asking for people to come forward with information.
That's right. There's been these billboards which have been requesting people to come forward. I think it's been polarising people. I think it's a little far-fetched to call her a Lindy Chamberlain, you know, to compare her to that. But there's been such enormous controversy and speculation. And there has been, you know, enormous public attention and interest in it. I think some of the media down there have been reporting everything. There's not a lot of coverage, though, you'd notice in you know, the mainland, as they call us, from if you're in Tasmania, the mainland press. But down there in Tassie, it's been, it's been heavily covered, and I'd imagine it still will be.
Rochelle, absolutely fascinating case, and we'll be keeping an eye on what happens in the near future with that that appeal that she's hoping to make. Thank you very much for joining us to talk crime this Thursday night.
My pleasure, Suzanne. Thank you.
Rochelle Jackson, true crime author and regular contributor here on Nightlife.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.